Hi, everybody. This is Micha Sifri from Personal Democracy Media, and welcome back to our ongoing series of PD Plus, Personal Democracy Plus, conference calls with movers, shakers, thinkers, innovators at the intersection where technology collides with politics, government, and society. And today I'm really excited to be welcoming to the call Howard Rheingold, an old friend of PDF, and gosh, I you know, it's hard to do justice to any introduction to Howard. He has been writing about the online frontier for so long. Well, he basically invented the language that we all use. I mean, you can go all the way back 25 years and find the first reference to virtual community coming from Howard, and Smart Mobs, which came out 10 years ago, which essentially presaged a great many of the uses of social media and technology to challenge authority. And we've seen in the last year or two how a lot of the ideas in Smart Mobs have played out across places like the Middle East. Today, we're going to dig in with Howard on his new book, NetSmart, How to Thrive Online, and in particular, focus on, you know, the gleanings that he has really packed this book with a particular emphasis on what it means to be network smart, how to make the most of your online network, how to tune how you use your social networks online, and we'll be getting into all of that in a moment. So, Howard, welcome. And you know what? What would be great to start things out is, you know, if you would say a little bit about, you know, why you chose to write NetSmart. What you know, sort of put you in the mood that said this is the next book that you want to do. And you know, just to sort of nudge a little on that, I have to say I wonder if there's an element here of you know, we better get this right, that, you know, maybe all the wonderful stuff that we see people doing with networking, connectivity, and so on, that maybe it isn't going quite as well as we'd hoped. So there's a need to, in effect, educate. So I'm wondering, you know, with that as a starting point, tell us, you know, a bit about, you know, why you wrote the book and what you're hoping to achieve you know, by getting it out there.
Well, you know, in some ways this book is different from anything I've done before in the sense that it's very prescriptive. It's an activist book. It's an intent to put tools in the hands of people to influence the outcome of the infosphere. And I agree with your statement. I don't think that it is guaranteed that our use of the technologies that have been made available to us, the internet, mobile communications, the web, social media, that those are all necessarily going to work out to be good things for us as individuals and as communities. Mm. In regard to that question, that's one that I've been asked, and I've asked myself for a very long time. Previous books, I really wasn't prescribing so much as trying to foresee. In the 1980s, I saw personal computers as something that by the year 2000, hundreds of millions of people would be using and would be much more powerful than they were when I started writing about them. And Tools for Thought was really about where might we be going? How might this be changing our minds and our relationships and democracy? And what was it? 8 years later, in the virtual community, I was asking, you know, kind of the same questions of where the people are using computer networks to communicate with, where might we be going? And in Smart Mobs, it was about the convergence of the personal computer, the internet, and the mobile communication device. What does that mean? At each of these stages, critics and my own questioning have asked, well, is this going to be any good for us? And increasingly, looking at that question, looking at some of the people who have thought about that question. You know, technology criticism is not new. It's just somewhat obscured for recent years. I've become convinced that the answer, at least in part, is it depends on what we know. It depends on what we means. How many people on Earth are going to have the know-how to use the technology that is available to them to their benefit, and how many people are going to be manipulated through their use of that technology by others? And of course, along the way, a lot of my experience is raising a daughter who started using search engines. I needed to sit down with her and talk with her about the facts of life, about crap detection online, teaching students in universities and realizing that this digital native stuff was not as simple as people have made it out to be, that young people may be able to text with one hand behind their back and they may Facebook all day. That doesn't mean they necessarily know what they are doing with all of the online media that are available to us. So it seemed to me that the criticism we've been seeing lately is important, particularly that based on evidence. The kind of critiques we're seeing from Nicholas Carr and Sherry Turkle about the downsides, the pitfalls, the prices that we didn't realize we are going to pay for the benefits of our technologies. And I feel very strongly that we need to think critically about our enthusiasms when it comes to technology. But criticism, while necessary, isn't sufficient. Knowing that something may be broken or it may have hidden cost isn't the same as telling you what to do about it. So that's really where the urge to write this book arose, which was, I think that we can make a difference. That is, I can make a difference by trying to compile this material and make it available. And those who educate themselves and educate others can raise the what Engelbart called the collective IQ, the level of cluefulness of people who use media. And that in itself should have an effect, that it's not the technology but the way that people use it that has the most powerful influence on the future.
But do you see in the moment that we're in now, right? So we're I think it's fair to say that we're beginning to live in, you know, what Clay Shirky likes to refer to as the time where the technology begins to sort of fade into the background, and it's the social uses that are you know, more ubiquitous. You know, I if I had to summarize your argument in a few words, I think it would be, you know, there are tremendous social benefits, societal benefits to being connected, to being open, to sharing appropriately, and that, you know, in many ways, NetSmart is about how shall we do that well? What should you as an individual know about how to do that well? But before we, you know, sort of dive from the 30,000-foot level down into the, you know, more of those details, are you still convinced? I the book is a very optimistic view that the benefits outweigh the dangers. But have you encountered anything over, you know, maybe the last few years that's given you doubt about you know, maybe we are underestimating the dark side of being always on, of being so connected, of you know, my fear, I should say, is the element of distraction, how much our attention seems to be fragmenting, you know, both as individuals and as a society, and that, you know, I think a lot of us who have an optimistic view about all sorts of things believe we'll figure out our way through that. But, you know, do you ever have a dark moment where you say, you know, maybe we are amusing ourselves to death, the way Neil Postman argued?
You know, I published Postman when I was editor of the Whole Earth Review, and some people may even remember Jerry Mander, who wrote who wrote a very strong book on technology criticism in the early 1990s. What was it called?
It was called Five Arguments Against Television, I think.
Five Arguments Against Television was the one that made his name. And then he did another one about in defense. Defense of the Wild. And when I sat down and talked with him about, okay, let's assume that we are increasingly caught up in a technology that is making people more like good cogs in the machine and less like what we consider to be humane. Where did that all start? Where did we go wrong? And his answer was agriculture. And, you know, since then I have educated myself. I really have been uncomfortable with a lot of the critiques of the dark side of technology recently, because they seem to me to be shallow. If you look at Lewis Mumford and Jacques Ellul and Langdon Winner, these are names which are virtually unknown probably to most of the people who consider themselves fairly well-read about what's happening with technology today. But for decades, there's been some deep thinking about, you know, where does the alienation, the disconnection come from? And, you know, I think it's true that hunters and gatherers, there was a book called Stone Age Economics by an anthropologist a number of years ago that did some pretty good back-of-the-envelope calculations that said hunters and gatherers led the kind of lives that we consider to be the good life. They had more time, they had spent less time earning a living, earning their food, and more time for family, for art, for spiritual expression. There were some drawbacks. If you were too old to keep up with the tribe, tough luck. Children died a lot more easily. But for the most part, I think there's something to be said for that. But the fact of the matter is that we live on a planet of 7 billion people. Hunting and gathering is not an answer for us. We're in this situation. We've got to deal with it. So I would say I'm less of an optimist and more of a hopeful person. I think that we are all descended from a long line of predecessors who thought there must be some way out of this pretty bad-looking situation. And the human species has faced pretty bad-looking situations several times in the past, where we were down to a couple of thousand. And in fact, agriculture may have really come from a period of climate change about 15,000 years ago. So my question was, well, given the situation, what do we do about it? And I think you mentioned distraction. Pew Internet and American Life Study reveals that one in six Americans have admitted to bumping into something or someone while walking down the street texting. And you know, I think we've all had that terrifying experience of driving down the freeway at high speed and noticing that the person in the automobile next to us is looking at their phone.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're a parent, there is a constant contest between the iPhone or the BlackBerry and your child's attention. If you are a professor, you're dealing with a classroom full of students who are looking at their screens, not at you. I have a picture that I use to illustrate the way screens are an attention magnet. It's a picture of Mark Zuckerberg at a press conference, and he's got a whiteboard that he's working on, and every single person in the picture is looking at their screen. Now, you know, presumably they are journalists and they are doing real-time reporting on this, but
right.
I think you don't have to argue that there is a strong call to our attention, that these screens are attention magnets, that distraction is a big part of the obstacles to getting things done in a day. I'm asking, is it the technology that's forcing us to do this, or have we simply not learned how to deploy our attention? And once you ask that question, it turns out that there's a lot of evidence from contemplative traditions to modern neuroscience. You want to look at a book like The Mindful Brain by Siegel. Goes into a lot of detail about the ways that people can learn to redeploy their attention or to gain some control over their attention. So that's why in the book the first chapter is about the fundamental literacy of attention. I think it's what you build everything else on, and I think it's The good news there, again, I guess I am accused of being an optimist, but I'm also, you know, hopeful. Hope is a choice. So I'm looking around.
Sure.
So what are the choices that we have? And one choice is to begin to pay attention to our attention. And the good news there is that paying any attention to how you are deploying your attention has an immediate effect that is significantly more effective than not paying attention at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
there's a way to go
it,
after that.
Yeah. Let's take you're a highly networked guy in all senses of the word, and you know, folks should go to Rheingold.com and you put a tremendous amount of effort into also making a lot of your work available to people online. I mean, you've got an extensive social network, which I'm sure takes a lot of time and attention on your part. How do you juggle the fire hose? What is your practice, and what can people learn from that?
Well, you know, I'll have to say that this is not sort of a cold-blooded, calculated strategy. It's what I was drawn into doing. It's something I have enjoyed doing since I discovered it. When I wrote about virtual communities, I talked about the fact that I'd been alone in a room for a good 10 years when I got online. You know, as a writer, the world is full of distractions. Believe me, as one of my objections to Nicholas Carr's book was that he said that the world of social media was so full of distractions that in order to read the book, he had to move to a cabin in Colorado. Believe me, before the online world, writers have always had the sharpest pencils, the cleanest dishes, the most well-weeded garden. The world is full of distractions for a writer. Ultimately, it's up to you to say, okay, I've got to get my work done for the day. When I discovered the world online, it was like writing as a performing art. I am still drawn to that on a daily basis. I don't feel like, okay, I've got to go and enhance my reputation and make money online. I'm thinking, what new is there to learn out there? What new is there to teach out there? It's tremendously exciting to me, the way the library was tremendously exciting to me when I discovered it when I was a kid. Of course, there comes a point in the day when you've got to have the output, and if I don't put the words out there, then the checks don't come in and I don't pay the bills. So that's always been a kind of strong Darwinian pressure on my attention long before social media came along. And you know, I have to say, in defense of distraction, I'm all over the place. I've got my email, I've got Twitter, I've got three or four virtual communities going at once, I've got RSS feeds, I've got, you know, curation tools, I pay attention to Digo and Scoop It and Pearl Trees. I've got information coming in and going out all over the place. I love it. If you're interested in knowledge, you're interested in learning, there's never been a better time to be alive. In order to discipline myself, I really have to keep in mind what is it that I'm intending to accomplish. So that becomes pretty quantifiable when you're writing a book. I've got so many days to get so many pages done. That means if I do the backwards calculations, I've got so many words to get written by the end of the day today. So one of the things that I've done and that I recommend to people is to start your day by simply thinking about what are your priorities today. And there are days in which you don't have a deadline, and clicking on the cute cat video or getting involved in an argument with a stranger on the internet or following that next link, that may be part of what you need to do to learn and to build networks and to communicate. Or it may be that I've got to get 2,000 words done by the end of the day. So I write down 5 or 6 words, 2 or 3 goals for the day on a piece of paper. I put that in the periphery of my vision right next to my computer. And at some point during the day, my glance falls upon that piece of paper, and I ask myself, where is my attention, and is it getting me any closer to where I need to go by the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I emphasize that it's not really much more disciplined than that. It's just a matter of drawing attention to what I'm paying attention to and what, according to my own priorities, I'm supposed to paying attention to. It's just a simple way of establishing an attentional habit. So I have looked at the research, and I'm sure that many of the people who are interested in the subject know of Cliff Nass's research at Stanford, in which he showed pretty definitively that people who believe that they are effective multitaskers and are getting their work done more efficiently are actually degrading their performance at the component task, or at least about 95% of the people who are tested. I'm really interested in the other 5%. And that's another category. But one of the methods that has been recommended is to set a little timer for 20 minutes or 25 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and focus for that 20 minutes without distraction, without paying attention to the little red flag that tells you there's something new happening on Facebook or there's a new email in. And then
mm-hmm.
at the end of that period, when your timer goes off, then just spend 10 minutes going wherever you want. Allow your mind to be attracted to whatever it's attracted to. So there are a number of different strategies, but I think the underlying rule of thumb is, who's going to be in charge? Everybody and every robot who wants your attention out there, or you? And I think once you start making that decision regularly on a daily basis, you begin to develop a sense for it. So, I'm all for distraction. I think focus has its uses, but it's not everything. Productivity is not everything. Getting the big picture is important. Connecting with people, flow, all of those things don't really require focus. So I don't think it's a matter of focus is good and distraction and multitasking is bad.
Mm-hmm. As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, a lot of people, I suspect, there are probably two types of listeners to sort of be addressing. One is the sort of folks who are, very networked. They're online. We're already plugged in maybe to too much. And, for that group, your arguments are, I think there's a visceral understanding of the need to focus and to, figure out how to discipline your own attention. But then there's this other group, which I want you to address for a second, which is people who whose response to all this social sharing, real-time, 24/7 connectivity, all that, is to say, I don't want to go near it. It's too much. I couldn't possibly handle it. Who are staying away. Maybe they just go online to check their email and maybe look up the headlines on Yahoo News. And what would you say to folks like that about why it's so important to jump into this space, to get comfortable to use it in a smart way?
Well, I would jump up a level first and say that one of the things that you discover when you begin looking at issues of networks and collective intelligence is that diversity of networks, diversity of the population in a community or a network is very important. It raises the collective IQ of that community. It also enables them to make decisions that are less extreme. So I think it's important to kind of our mental and social ecology to have a certain number of people who say, that's just not for me. I'm going to spend most of my life offline. So I think it's a good thing to have the people who question the utility of spending a lot of time online. I wouldn't want to live in a world without them. I also think that there is a time to unplug. I unplug every day. I spend time barefoot in my garden. I spend time out walking my dogs in the countryside. I turn off the phone. I turn off the the music I'm listening to and pay attention to where I am. I think once you think, well, that's a good thing to do, it's healthy for me, I'll start doing it, you discover that it has its own pleasures. So just let me preface that by saying I think it's a good thing for some people to be offline a lot or entirely. Mm-hmm. I think it's good for everybody to unplug part of the time. But back when I was enthusiastic about evangelizing, about getting online, I really didn't start with trying to tell people what I thought was wonderful about the world online. I would ask them what they were interested in. Is it cooking? Is it butterfly collecting? Is it political action? And then I would show them the way that they could use an online tool to do what it is that they want to do. So, you know, I think this is the flip side of the coin of the legitimate criticism that signing an online petition, simply, you know, slacktivism, that simply doing stuff online is not sufficient to change the world, that you need to take political action, you need to participate in demonstrations and boycotts, you need to get out the vote, you need to participate in online discussions of issues, and you need to participate in face-to-face discussions of issues. But as we've seen, the other side of that coin is the people who knew how to use Facebook and YouTube and email and Google Maps, they were the ones who were able to get action going very, very quickly in North Africa and the Middle East in the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. I think that's a complicated debate. I'm not saying that social media caused these revolutions, but I think that it's very clear that the pace and the scope of what is happening in the world today is facilitated by people who know how to use these media. And I think the reason it took 10 years from when I wrote Smart Mobs, looking at what had happened in the Philippines with people texting to overthrow the Estrada regime and the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle, what they call the Battle for Seattle. These were just the earliest signals that people were doing things politically that they had not been able to do before. It took 10 years for the Arab Spring, for Occupy movement to happen, simply because I believe it took that long for the literacy, for the know-how to spread to enough people. Because we've certainly had the mobile devices and we've had the internet all that time. I think that's what we're seeing now, is that people, if you are in healthcare, you've got to be online. It's how you connect with people who share your disease, or are caregivers for people with a disease you're a caregiver for. If you're involved in politics or scholarship, what field does not have something important happening online? So my answer there is, look at it. You know, if your interest is in working with your hands to do clay sculpture, you're going to have to spend a certain amount of time not with your hands on a keyboard, but with your hands in clay sculpture. But never before in history have you had access to other artists who are working in the same medium that you are, and markets for you to sell your art, to show your art. The whole elite structure of the art world has been supplemented by another much more populist world, and people being able to get their arts and crafts out to each other.
Let's talk a little bit about politics, because obviously this is, you know, a prime area of interest for personal democracy folks. You know, you mentioned all those episodes and movements from, you know, the Philippines to Occupy and the Arab Spring. And I don't disagree at all that they are substantial examples of how, you know, mass connectivity and knowledge of how to use mass connectivity have, you know, given opposition movements, uprisings, you know, efforts to overthrow authoritarian or corrupt regimes a leg up. Let's stipulate that. One question that it feels unfinished to me is, if the internet, if being networked, works as well, you know, it works very well for what you would, you might call stop energy, right? Let's stop this thing from happening. Stop SOPA, you know, another good example. What we don't yet see is how it turns into positive make energy in the political arena. So, for example, you know, the youth movement and the labor, you know, and the human rights movement in Egypt, which was so important to opposing the Mubarak regime, which, you know, had some very smart network weavers like Wael Ghanim using platforms like Facebook to figure out how to break the people's fear of challenging the regime, and then ultimately, you know, literally putting a date for when the revolution should start. They succeeded in you know, developing enough force to overthrow Mubarak, but they didn't really put a different power in place. And some people, you know, I guess the more pessimistic are worried that, you know, this is just paving the path for the Muslim Brotherhood. But leaving that to the side, you know, in the past, revolutions usually involve, you know, a counter power replacing the existing power. And for argument's sake, what we're seeing now with these networked movements is success in tearing down an existing power, but not as much success in replacing it with something else. Now, do you think that's because, I would argue it's because of the tools, the practices that we have are just not mature enough? I mean, Mark Zuckerberg didn't design Facebook to be a political organizing platform. It just so happens that people use it for political organizing. It isn't particularly great for, you know, collaborative writing of party platforms or of, you know, of a, you know, of a positive agenda, much harder. Do you agree? I mean, where do you think we are on this, you know, as we live through this gigantic transition that we're going through?
Well, boy, there's a, you know, we could spend the rest
big
of
hard
time
question,
here.
But I got to ask you.
Unpacking that question alone, there's a lot of different levels going on here. I think, mm-hmm. you know, first of all, you need to at least touch base with the notions of power and counterpower. And, you know, power, those who have power resist counterpower. And those who do not have power and for whom life without power also means life without liberty, life without justice, they seek power. They seek to oppose power. And until very recently, the communication tools were really in the hands of centralized power. You know, the police have always been able to speak to each other wirelessly, or, you know, at least mm-hmm. since, what, the 1950s and the 1960s, they had radios in their cars. Demonstrators did not until very recently.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, without a doubt, there is a tremendous sea change. You know, I wrote a chapter for an edited volume from MIT Press a few years ago in which I compiled examples that I got from news reports, I got from searching online, of political events in the world that had been significantly tipped, whether they were demonstrations or they were elections, by people using phones. I left out Facebook and other social media, Twitter, just people using phones. There's a tremendous amount of it all over the world that has happened. The Spanish elections after the terrorist bombings, those were tipped. The Korean elections when President Roh was elected largely because of his online constituency. So many examples in China. The generic story in China is peasant is run over by Mercedes. Someone takes a picture on their phone and spreads the word. The activism of the parents of the children who were killed in the schools that collapsed during the earthquake in China, the people who successfully opposed the building of the farmers who successfully opposed the building of a chemical plant in China, probably tens of thousands. thousands of such incidents every year that we never hear about. So there's a lot happening. There's a sea change happening all over the world. You know, as Evgeny Morozov has correctly pointed out, that doesn't mean that power remains asleep. They were asleep. They weren't aware of what the internet and mobile communications mean. And another dimension here is you said that Facebook wasn't designed for activism. People just used it that way. The same thing is true of almost every medium in that people appropriate them for their uses if they see a way to use it. SMS was invented as a way for telephone engineers to communicate with each other, but teenage girls discovered it was a way to communicate with each other without their parents or their teachers knowing what they were saying. It's almost hydraulic. If there's a way for a new communication medium, like water, to find its level, it will. So I think that saying that something is populist and empowers those who are not out of power is not the same as saying that they will succeed in changing the political system. We now get into a more complex environment in which, you know, people's religious and economic circumstances and their communications networks. I was told that the events in Iran, the unsuccessful revolution in protest of the June, I think, 2009 elections, that those were really sparked by women's networks, women's face-to-face networks. You know, in a world where the men and women have somewhat different quarters, women are a source of exchange of information. So, you know, I think when you're talking about politics, it becomes of getting things accomplished, it becomes a more complex issue than, unfortunately, what cheap journalism has. Cheap journalism is what gives us headlines like the Twitter revolution, you know, paints a complex picture in simple words. I would say that and elections. So the U.S. is coming up with an election. You know, there's been a technology arms race going on for a long time. It was really the right wing in the United States really invented the use of databases to find out who your people are. Richard Viguerie invented this idea of bringing up an issue like, well, today it's gay marriage, gay rights. This will bring people who will share your political viewpoint about other issues into visibility. If you can induce them to give you signals that enable you to put them in a database, then you can mobilize them on election day. You know, on the other side, I think the Clinton election had a lot to do with using databases to recognize the Reagan Democrats, the people in the middle that would elect him. So I think, you know, sophisticated use of technology can be used by those in power. I would say, if I wanted to make a counter argument to your claim that nothing positive has happened, I'd say, where did the Howard Dean campaign come from? Yes, he lost. He didn't even make the nomination. But never before, really, in modern American presidential politics, has a significant candidate for the presidency emerged, not because the party leaders chose them, but because a whole lot of bloggers decided to do so.
Sure.
So, you know, I guess if you get the picture of what I'm saying, there's action and there's counteraction. It's Hegelian. We're seeing a development of, you know, now we're seeing that countries like Iran and China, and they're certainly attempting to do it in the U.S. They can control communications. They can surveil communications. The technology that we thought was inherently decentralized and uncontrolled, measures are being taken to control it now. So, again, you asked, why did I write this book? I think that the outcome is uncertain. The technology is not going to save anyone. Not knowing how to use the technology, I think, will be more destructive to the populations who are not in power than to those who have power.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I would just add, you know, that the thread through the book that really stands out is that the idea that the advantages, you know, to you as an individual or to a group with a cause or a concern or a passion or whatever, that the collective intelligence that you can foster and tap into and so on, that those are that's available to everybody, and that can be a game changer, or at least something that enhances people's voice, people's capacity in terms of the process. So those are, you know, I think that's absolutely right. And then it's whether we use it in a mindful way or allow our attention to be dispersed and distracted remains a very big unknown. Let me take a pause here because we actually gone past the half hour point, and I forgot to invite folks listening. If you do want to make a comment or ask a question of Howard Rheingold, we're discussing his new book, NetSmart, How to Thrive Online. What you should do is just hit *6 on your phone, and I'll pull you into the conversation. As always, I'm happy to keep the conversation going if people are bashful. Are there any, you know, Howard, just as you watch, the debate play out over, the strength and power of networks, in the last, period since you've written the book, is there anything that either surprised you or troubled you, in terms of, or is it nothing new under the sun now? I mean, I don't know which it would be from your perspective. You've been watching this for so long.
I'm troubled by the tirelessness of the forces of control. That you have to be a technology geek and a policy wonk to even understand what net neutrality is about. The extension of copyright laws, too many people think this is about artists getting paid for their work. The attempts to reassert control, now that the Internet has disintermediated so many different institutions, they're not going away. They're well-funded, and never before in history have incumbent industries been able to bend the political process to the degree that they are now worldwide in order to prevent innovations from putting them out of business. You know, if the buggy whip manufacturers had at their disposal the resources that the recording industry has today, maybe we wouldn't have automobiles. I mean, this is not capitalism, by the way. Capitalism is supposed to be creative destruction, using the political process to prevent innovation in a very large way is, I think, a new thing, a very troubling thing, and it worries me because activists have a lot of things to worry about and to work on. Lobbyists are single-minded and well-funded.
Well, you must be heartened by what took place over the fight over the SOPA and PIPA bills. I mean, Congress was hit by a tidal wave of public communication in opposition of those bills. I mean, the numbers, you know, anywhere 7 to 13 million emails, phone calls, faxes in a matter of days. I don't think they have any clue what hit them.
Yeah.
Did you think it would be that big?
It?
Yeah. But, I mean, for some of us, what was astounding about that, you know, when I hear about, you know, my son's, you know, peers, you know, he's 18 and friends of his, you know, this was the first time they had made a phone call to their member of Congress.
Yeah. I am certainly hopeful about that. But, you know, those battles aren't going to go away. They're going to come back again and again and again. And I hope that calling your congressional representative people don't become tired of that, because these bills are going to be reintroduced. You know, on the other hand, the whole surveillance apparatus. The Obama administration, as you well know, is no better than the Bush administration. In fact, they've continued to push means of surveillance forward. There was just the previous issue of Wired magazine had that article about the new million square foot server facility that the NSA is putting in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
The means of surveilling people's lives, the cameras that recognize people's faces, the data valence that looks over every click that you make, every time you cross a bridge and use a transponder, all of the digital trails we make. Now there are artificial intelligence means for putting those things together. And I don't know whether it's clear that this is ultimately going to be effective in fighting terrorism, but it's certainly effective in controlling the population.
But in the face of that, you are a avid web user. I mean, I'm guessing you don't encrypt all your email or worry about the cookie settings on your browser, do you? I mean, are those, if and I'm not disagreeing that those are things to be concerned about, but do you, you know, you don't really talk about that much about protecting your privacy online. I mean, there's sort of a flip side here, right, which is the benefits of sharing versus the benefits of protecting your privacy. So where do you come down on that?
If I was to become seriously involved in planning concrete political action, I would be a lot more careful about the communication media that I used. And, of course, you know, there's social network analysis simply by the people that I know. They're, you know, people who have access to that on the surveillance side can make lots of guesses about who I am and what I believe and what I'm doing. And my concern in the book in regard to privacy is about what you would call informed consent, that one of the facts of life these days is you've got to sit down with your kids before they get online and tell them that what they put online is going to be there forever, it's going to be searchable, and it's going to be connectable to their name, and that anybody in the world can read it, can duplicate it, and can reproduce it and send it around the world instantaneously. These are all new things. People have done stupid things. They've gotten drunk at parties. They've had fights with their best friends. They've said things that they wish they hadn't said since forever. But now it's a permanent, searchable, worldwide record. So I think the issues of privacy are really issues going forward for a young person today of what is their life's profile going to look like. Aside from state political surveillance, there's simply the matter of, are you going to get that job? Your date's going to Google you before you go out with them. What are they going to find out about you?
Right.
It's really a whole new world here.
Okay, I'm going to stop and take a question. We have looks like a question from our friend Lorelei Kelly. Go ahead.
Hi, Richie. Always know. Thank you. I'm calling from Washington. Thank you, Mr. Rangel, and I'm a big fan. I wanted to push back a little bit on the whole issue of the effectiveness of sort of more and more noise and more identifiable noise in your district as an effective method to change Congress, for example. I'm working on a way to redistribute functions of Congress right now. And I think one of the bigger problems in Congress is it can't handle the noise. Its phone systems continue to break down. Its filtering system is left over from 1946, especially on these issues of global public interest. It simply can't hear or understand the world because the information environment is so obsolete. And my experience having worked on the Hill is that the people with the expertise and the credible knowledge aren't present in an effective way. And what the institution lacks is a sort of curated knowledge. It's not the tsunami of opinion that comes at it. I mean, realistically, how many times can we shut off the internet to get our way? In Congress, that looks like a really successful a tantrum that you throw once, but it can't possibly be a standing support system for our legislators and leaders to make informed evidence-based decisions. And I'm wondering if you've seen ways that, like, crowdsourcing expertise has been effective and sort of harvesting this cognitive surplus based on relationships, so you're flipping the currency of influence away from money and toward relationships, because my experience is that those relationships aren't spent well at all in the institutions of power.
Boy, well, you say you're pushing back. I can't say that I disagree with you about the problem there. And I think that, you know, the larger issue, whether you're talking about the Egyptian activists or the Occupy movement or the people who opposed SOPA and PIPA successfully, is how do you turn a demonstration into a movement? Getting people to call Congress or to join a demonstration on the streets, those are significant, but it's not an institution. It's not an ongoing movement. The lobbyists, the political parties, they are ongoing movements. They are organized. They communicate on a daily basis. They have funding and an agenda that doesn't go to sleep. So I think it's really important. Besides the standing political parties, how do people who share interests, who are passionate enough to take action, create some kind of institutions of enduring value? I don't know the answer to that. Mika asked me a long time ago in the conversation whether the things that you know, I sort of almost despair about, the degree of technological ignorance. I would say it's worse than ignorance. It's pride in ignorance. It's know nothingness in Congress. It's so endemic to Congress. There used to be something called the Office of Technology Assessment that mm-hmm. Tried on a bipartisan, nonpartisan basis to assess what technologies might mean for people of all kinds and to inform Congress about it, or at least to inform the young 20-somethings on the Hill who told their bosses what things meant for their political constituents. That was zeroed out in the Gingrich Congress of, 1992, and it's never been replaced. And, in the early 90s, when I was editing Whole Earth Review and was looking for somebody in Washington who knew anything about, they didn't even call it the Internet yet. They're calling it the superhighway. The only person who really knew anything was Al Gore, and it was discouraging to see him so mocked for that, because he actually did know what he was talking about. And I think there are a few people, Patrick Leahy, there are a few people on the Hill who have some technological knowledge, but given the importance of technology, the degree to which they only listen to lobbyists and don't really look at what the underlying issues are, and there's no institution for people to talk about the broader implications of technology with Congress, I think that's a huge hole in our roadmap to the future. I think I'm afraid of it.
Right. Thank you, Lorelei, for that. How do you think libraries? We're almost running out of time, but I want to just throw one more sort of bone on the pile for you to chew on. I just spent the spring teaching a course at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and I was really struck when we got the tour of the library, and it's an amazing library system they have there. Basically the tour of the library involved sitting in a conference room for an hour looking at web pages, because that's where all the information is now. It's about how do you access information. Librarians are Sherpas in certain ways. But do you think that, in terms of where, who has the role of helping us become more net smart? I mean, could it be that this is, the institution in society that could most play that role is the lowly librarian? Does that make sense to you? Are you striking a chord with that community in a way?
There was some conflict 15 years ago between the book librarians and the digital librarian. So I don't think that there's much conflict today. And, you know, I wrote the book looking in two directions. One was about personal empowerment. I want to give know-how based on what I know and what people I interview know and the research that I've done to individuals to be more successful. You know, something I would have given to my daughter when she first got online, something that I would like people to give to a bright high school graduate to enable them to be more successful and more effective. The other direction is the commons. What can we possibly do to improve the state of the online world? And you know, we haven't spent much time talking about it, but there's an awful lot wrong there. There's an awful lot of really ugly speech going on. There's an awful lot of really bad information out there. We desperately need an institution in our society that has a physical place where people can go, that has experts who can help people find their way, and a purpose that has to do with improving the state of the information commons, the communication commons, the knowledge commons for the entire country. Unfortunately, the budget crises are causing us to close fire departments. We do have, courtesy of Andrew Carnegie, a building in most towns and cities in the U.S. that is dedicated to this purpose. Just because it is no longer necessary to have that brick and mortar building there to house the books, I think it's essential that we keep that place and that we keep the librarians there and that we enable them and publicize it. We enable a digital literacy centers to emerge from libraries. Let's not go reinvent the wheel in 10 years when the necessity I'm pointing to becomes painfully obvious to everyone. Let's not have destroyed the places and the profession and the people who are set up to do that right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think many of the best libraries and librarians are already moving in this direction, you know, figuring out how, as they see, you know, so many people come to libraries because it is a place where you can go online for free if you can't afford broadband. And, you know, they are learning centers, they are community centers. Unfortunately, sometimes they're daycare centers too, but and senior centers. But there's no question that it feels to me like the library is this sort of hidden asset in this conversation that we shouldn't forget. That part of if we are going to have a digital literacy, you know, how to foster it more broadly than, you know, just the sort of elite getting it, because certainly those people will, and it may turn out that libraries are part of that answer. Well, assuming they are, I'm hoping they will have many copies of your books, including NetSmart, available for people to borrow and browse. Howard, you are a national treasure, an international treasure. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. It's never enough time, and I'm sure we only, you know, brushed the surface of the things that we could have talked about on this call, but our hour is up. So I thank you. I thank everybody for listening. This has been Personal Democracy Media's PD Plus call with Howard Rheingold on Network Smarts. Thank you again, Howard, and hope our paths cross sometime soon.
Likewise, Mika.
Take care.